Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you from the shores of Western Japan on the 5th of April, 2012. It is still the 4th of April, 2012 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line today by Kevin Ryan, a former site manager for Environmental Health Laboratories, a division of Underwriter Laboratories, who was fired by Underwriter Laboratories in 2004 for publicly questioning the National Institute of Standards and Technology report on the World Trade Center investigation. And since then, Kevin Ryan, of course, has done a prolific amount of research and investigation into many different aspects of 9/11. Kevin, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, James. It's good to be here.
All right. I'd like to go over your latest article, which has been posted to Washington's blog and other websites besides. It's called Secret Service Failures on 9/11, A Call for Transparency. And I think it makes some very interesting points about the Secret Service detail and their actions or lack thereof on 9/11. Let's start going over that article and some of the points that you raised there.
Okay. Yeah, there are several parts to that article. The first one asks the question whether the Secret Service was aware in some ways of the events of 9/11. And the reason that that question is asked is that the President of the United States was very well protected in many ways, except from the very obvious danger of terrorists from hijacked airliners. So we had snipers on the roof of the building. It was well planned. People were in the hallways. The police and the Secret Service were all over the place. And yet the president was allowed to enter this building when at 9:03 in the morning on September 11th, everyone else in the country was watching the second plane hit the World Trade Center. And frankly, most people in government were aware of multiple hijackings at that time. They were aware that these planes were being crashed in the buildings, at least one of them. And so the question becomes, why did the president enter the building? Why was he allowed to enter the building and put all those people at risk, as well as himself? And why did the Secret Service allow that? And then just minutes after he entered the building and entered the classroom, the report of the second crash into the World Trade Center was made. And he was told, and everyone knew, including everyone in the United States at that time, including myself, we knew that the country was under a series of coordinated terrorist attacks. And yet the president stayed in that classroom for quite some time, and he has actually stayed in the building itself for another 30 minutes or more, even giving a national presentation on television, essentially announcing to the world that he's still there in that building. Which part of the difficulty there is that this photo opportunity of the president in this classroom, which was to support his education policy, was announced 4 days before that, and the visitors to this event were brought in 2 days before, given thorough instruction. Everyone knew that he was there in Sarasota at this Booker Elementary, and yet he stayed there for 30 minutes after the second crash into the World Trade Center. So this indicates foreknowledge on the part of the Secret Service, at least, if not others, that this building and the president was not a target on 9/11. Some of the other points made in the article have to do with the protection of the vice president and how quickly he was removed from his location, which was his office in the White House. And there's some contradictory accounts. Most of them put Vice President Cheney being removed by the Secret Service just after 9 o'clock. At the time that everybody was learning that the second plane had impacted the World Trade Center, and also at the time that the FAA, and we believe also the Secret Service, was aware that two other planes were hijacked and were both headed toward Washington. This article goes into evaluation of some FOIA release documents that were received by 9/11 researcher Aidan Monahan. I've done quite a bit of FOIA requests myself, but Aidan has done some spectacular work and really been persistent in the terms of following up. For example, on this request, he did ask for these documents, Secret Service knowledge, timelines, and was essentially refused. He was told, well, we can't find those documents. And then he asked again. And then they could find the documents. And they did release a number of kind of random documents. Unfortunately, not everything that really is important. I went into, in this article, interviews by two really critical people, one of them being Edward Marenzel, who was responsible for the president's activities in Sarasota, and also his boss, Carl Truscott, who was the special agent in charge of the Presidential Protective Division. And Carl Truscott was in the White House. He was taking precautionary measures at a quarter after nine. And yet the 9/11 Commission report says that Vice President Cheney was not removed from his office until 9:36, quite a bit later than that, and well over 30 minutes later than most of the witnesses say. Now, we have a White House photographer, we have the president's secretary, we have Richard Clark, all of these people saying that Vice President Cheney was removed from his office just after 9 o'clock. Why this is important? It's important to realize that there's one very critical testimony that puts Vice President Cheney in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the PEOC, at about 9:20 in the morning. And the reason that's important is that there is this testimony from Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta tells the story of how a young man would come in and give the vice president updates about one of the planes coming into Washington. And Mineta actually specifies that this is the plane, Flight 77, headed for the Pentagon. And he gives him reports at 50 miles out and at 30 miles out and at 10 miles out. Now, if Vice President Cheney didn't arrive in the PEOC until 9:38 or after, then he would not have been able to get those reports, according to Mineta. But all these other accounts say that he was whisked out of his office. He would have been there. And the Secret Service documents that have been released also indicate that Vice President Cheney would have been there in the PEOC prior to 9:30 a.m. That's validating the important testimony of Norman Mineta.
And I think in addition to the timeline of the Secret Service response to Cheney, of course, it's also important to take into account the nature of the actions they took in protecting him. And by his own admission, within minutes, well, again, the timeline we can't be sure of, but certainly quite within short order, Secret Service agents were literally hoisting him by his belt, his feet almost not touching the ground as they escorted him to the PEOC. So absolutely, the discrepancy between what happened with Cheney and what happened with Bush, I think, is telling in and of itself.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's other little things having to do with, for example, Mrs. Cheney, who, according to the Secret Service documents, was in the White House shelter area, kind of an interim area, almost a hallway, I think, on the way to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center. When Carl Truscott, the Secret Service agent in charge, came to get him, Mr. Cheney, Mrs. Cheney was there before 9:30 in the morning. Yet the official count says that Mrs. Cheney didn't even arrive at the White House till almost 10 o'clock in the morning. So there seems to be some very serious discrepancies in these various timelines. This article in the Secret Service also goes into an important question about why the military did not respond to an original request. That is, why the Secret Service, did not respond to an original request from Andrews Air Force Base to provide help. So, for example, Major Daniel Kane was a supervisor of flying at Andrews Air Force Base. And shortly after 9 o'clock again, he called his Secret Service contact. His name was Kenneth Beauchamp. And he said, we're available to help. You guys need any help? We've got jets available, essentially. And Beauchamp told him, no, we don't need any help. This is just after 9 o'clock. Second plane had already crashed in the World Trade Center, and apparently the Secret Service was aware of these other two planes coming in But Kenneth Beauchamp, at least, was telling Major Kane that Secret Service did not need help from Andrews Air Force Base. But Beauchamp did say he'd call back. So hang on, I'll call back. 30 minutes later, he never called back. In fact, he never called back at all. But 30 minutes later, someone else from the Secret Service called. This was right before Flight 77 was reported to impact the Pentagon. And that's when they were finally saying, get us some jets, some interceptor jets from Andrews. Well, that's curious in itself. That's 30 minutes difference almost between when the original offer was made by Major Kane and when he was taken up by that, by the Secret Service. The more glaring discrepancy is that jets didn't actually launch from Andrews for more than an hour after that. So 90 minutes after Major Kane originally offered help. And the reason for that is there's a lot of discussion about this General Worley who showed up. He was the supervisor, wasn't there originally. He was actually the commander of Andrews Air Force Base. And he showed up right around the time Flight 77 was impacting the Pentagon. And the official story says he was very confused about who had the authority to order jets to launch. And he wouldn't take the information from the Secret Service. It's all very confusing. General Worley's no longer with us. He died in a very unusual train accident in Washington. But it is really important for us to see that Andrews Air Force Base was only 10 miles away from the Pentagon. And it didn't launch jets until 10:38 in the morning, over an hour after the Pentagon was hit. And these weren't even armed jets. So if you're going to launch non-armed jets, at least you could do it around the time these buildings are being hit. But there is no explanation for why that was not done.
Well, let's drill down into this a little further. So obviously the actions or inactions of the Secret Service detail of Bush on that day are extremely puzzling at the very least, and due to the call for transparency on those actions, I think is a well-placed one. But in terms of protocol or procedures that should be followed in these situations, do we have any idea of what is actually written down, or if there's anything that we know that the Secret Service should have been doing in this situation?
Well, the only thing I referred to was a book that was written by an expert on the Secret Service who was also just really confused by why, for example, in the elementary school, the Secret Service didn't immediately move the president to a secure location. That's really the Presidential Protective Division, the PPD of the Secret Service. That's their entire job. And my understanding from, I can't name the exact references right now, but my understanding is that they don't really even require the authority to be given to them. It's their authority. If the president or the vice president or other people they're in charge of are in danger, they are to immediately move those people to a secure location. It would be nice to be able to reference, and I think that's a good follow-up action, the actual law that says this or the actual procedure in Secret Service documentation. I'll try to find that, but my understanding is that from experts who have studied it, this is just immediate. It's not even something that they would ask the president about. It's their job to do that, to protect the president. So,
well, okay, so let's draw out the implications of this, because again, the point of the article, obviously calling for greater transparency regarding the documentation of what was happening, the timeline, things like that. But really, what this amounts to is the fact that information is being withheld that would help us to determine what was really happening and how the Secret Service was responding and why they responded the way they did. And really, again, with so many of these things, when we start studying them regarding 9/11 in particular, the cover-up after the fact either indicates some sort of monumental failure, as indicated in your title, or perhaps the possibility always there of deliberate actions to confuse or obfuscate the response to that day. And of course, that's not really decidable from the information that they don't allow to leak out. So that's obviously part of why the call for transparency is important. But playing the devil's advocate role, people would inevitably say, well, the Secret Service consists of all sorts of different agents. These are trained professionals. They've worked their whole lives. Can we seriously be expected to believe that all of this Secret Service detail was in on some sort of plot and none of them have spilled the beans, et cetera, et cetera? How would you respond to that type of criticism?
Well, I think that there may be reason for us to see that not everyone at the elementary school was necessarily aware of everything that was going on. I mean, those of us who saw on television planes crashing into the World Trade Center, we were also hearing stories about more planes being hijacked than actually were. I was hearing stories about planes crashing in the National Mall. But as far as the Secret Service itself, they are almost like any other government agency that is compartmentalized. It's a top-down sort of an operation. So, you know, whoever is in charge of the detail, they would need to be making a decision or at least allowing others to make a decision. But all of the agents who are there, they wouldn't necessarily have the authority to override or even to... So they wouldn't necessarily have to be in on it, as we say. But I named a couple of people. Edward Marenzel, who was the supervisor of the detail that the president was being monitored by, and then his boss, Carl Truscott. I believe those two fellas knew that procedures needed to be followed and were not being followed. Whether or not they knew why, we can't say why they didn't follow procedure, why they didn't override others who may have been telling them to not move the president. But some of the reasons given in the 9/11 Commission report are just really weak. For example, there's two major reasons for why the president wasn't moved. One of them, the commission report says, well, Bush himself decided that, you know, he wanted to project calm. So he's going to sit there in the classroom reading the book, projecting calm. Now, remember, all of us in the United States, at least, were either listening to the radio or watching the television by this time. We were not calm, and I would think that most would agree that we would expect the president to take charge at that time, not sit and read a book and project calm. So that's a kind of a weak reason. And then the second reason was that the Secret Service, their determination was that, yes, it was an important and urgent time, but they didn't feel the need to immediately rush the president out of the room. So it's not a very strong, I can't remember the exact wording, something like that. They didn't feel the need to whisk him away right away, which is contradictory to some of the stories about the vice president. As you mentioned, he was pulled up by his arms and just dragged out of his office. According wherever the timeline fell out, that was the story. He was picked up and dragged out. They didn't ask him. They didn't worry about whether or not he was projecting calm or whether or not it was, it was a good thing to see. They moved him, and you would have thought that's what they would have done with the president as well. But, you know, there's more than just the movement of the president or the vice president. On this issue, there's also the question of whether or not air cover was appropriately requested for Bush's motorcade as it moved away to the airport. And then for Air Force One, as it flew around the country, apparently in a random fashion, first to Louisiana, then to Nebraska, then finally back to Washington. The Secret Service should have immediately requested air cover for the motorcade, which for some reason drove in the wrong direction, for one thing. I'm not really sure what to say about that. They had to turn the entire motorcade around because it was moving in the opposite direction of the airport and then head back to the airport. But there was no air cover for him. And again, this was well-publicized, a photo opportunity. There was evidence that there might have been an attempt on the president's life earlier that morning by some pseudo-journalists. And so you would think that there would have been more concern about hijacked airliners, if nothing else. And then the Air Force One situation was attempted to be explained by the 9/11 Commission report. And but basically, the president moved to Barksdale because, again, Edward Mirenzel, whose interview is not available to us, hasn't been released, upon which a lot of the 9/11 Commission answers are based, decided that Washington was too unstable for the president. So he flew to Barksdale in Louisiana. He stopped there and he gave a presentation again in Barksdale. He flew from there to Offutt in Nebraska. And then finally he got air cover on the way back from Nebraska to Washington. But that was several hours later, and leads again to the question of how anyone could have failed to see that with all these hijacked airliners and the importance of the president as an icon, if nothing else, that he wasn't protected by air cover.
All very, very interesting points, and there are so many different ways to explore them. And of course, I would suggest people go and take a look at your article. But ultimately, what would you like to come of this article? It's called A Call for Transparency. What kind of transparency are you looking for here?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'll let you in on a response I got to this article. I'm in periodic communication with one of the 9/11 Commission staff members. His name is Miles Karras, actually one of the more important investigators of the 9/11 Commission and authors of the 9/11 Commission report. And I didn't send him this particular article, but he did find it. He found it fairly rapidly. And atypical of his response, he came across as somewhat angry about it. And I'm not trying to tell tales on him here, but he believed that for example, Mineta was totally mistaken. He couldn't say why, but Mineta is just simply totally mistaken. And he got a little bit offensive about or defensive about his own research. But the main point he tried to make to me was that his report was based on primary evidence. And I said, that's exactly right. That's the title of the article, A Call for Transparency. Researchers like myself and Aidan, we have to have all these FOIA requests to get documents that Miles and his staff just had provided to him, interviews just available to him. And if we had all of that information, that's what I think, if anything, this article would ideally do. It would drive the release of Edward Mirenzel's interview transcript, of Carl Truscott's interview transcript, of the primary evidence upon which the 9/11 Commission report based their findings and answered all of these questions.
Absolutely. Well, extremely important. Well, let's shift gears a little bit to talk about another project that I know you were involved in last year during the September 11th anniversary, the 10th anniversary of September 11th. That weekend, there was a hearing in Toronto called the Toronto Hearings on September 11th. Perhaps for people who have never heard about this, can you tell us a little bit about what the Toronto Hearings were and how that came together?
Yes, the Toronto Hearings was a gathering of researchers from around the world, an international gathering of 9/11 researchers to present evidence challenging the official account of 9/11 and also evidence that has perhaps not seen as much exposure as it should. So we had some tremendous forerunners of the 9/11 truth movement, including people like Cynthia McKinney and Michelle Shostakovsky, Peter Dale Scott, and David Gray Griffin come and present. We also had a lot of scientists. We had Niels Herit And we had engineers and physicists like John Cole and I'm trying to remember all the names. It's difficult. David Chandler gave a great presentation. Barbara Honegger gave a presentation related to the Pentagon. And ultimately, we took all of this information that was presented over 4 days and tried to methodically present that to a panel of official, not quite judges, but almost like a tribunal of a distinguished people. They included Professor Richard Lee from the University of Toronto, Professor David Johnson from the University of Tennessee, Ferdinando Imposimato, who's a very distinguished judge from Italy, and Professor Herbert Jenkins from Toronto as well. And these four men tried to absorb all of this information, ask pertinent questions to analyze and bring out the details. And the end result will be, first of all, a DVD, which is 5 hours of, a little over 5 hours of highlights from the 4 days of the presentations. And then also a report that's going to include the text versions of all of the presentations, plus documents prepared by the panel themselves and recommendations for going forward. The report itself is being final edited by attorney James Gurley in Texas, whose International Center for 9/11 Studies was the sponsor of the event. The four main organizers, included myself and Adnan Zubairi from Toronto, Professor Graham McQueen, and soon to be Dr. Laurie Manuel, also from Canada. So it had a very strong Canadian and Ontario presence in the Toronto hearings, which is good, I think. But also all of these researchers from around the world, and we're trying to produce tangible products that will drive future actions and hopefully an internationally recognized investigation ultimately into the events of 9/11.
So talk about your own involvement in the hearings and how that came about.
Well, the four of us, three of the four organizers, were involved in a presentation here in Bloomington, Indiana, the year before. We brought Professor Graham McQueen and Laurie Manuel here to Bloomington as part of my local group, the 9/11 Working Group of Bloomington, as part of our 2010 event. We have done a lot of FOIA requests. We've put on presentations ourselves. And when we had Laurie and Graham here, we began to plan for something impressive for the 10th anniversary, something useful. And out of that came the Toronto hearings. I was asked to give originally a presentation that makes a lot of sense for me to give, and that is an evaluation of the NIST reports on the World Trade Center. That was what I was originally doing when I when I was brought into the 9/11 Truth Movement. It was my critique and public critique of those reports is what got me fired from Underwriters Laboratories. Of course, I've done a lot of other investigations since then, but I have a lot of knowledge about those reports and the questions still need to be answered relative to those. So I gave that one presentation. And then a few days later, I stood in for Professor Stephen Jones, who is a well-known 9/11 researcher who has done a lot to present evidence for thermitic materials, as we call them. That is thermite. The presence of thermite is pretty well established at the World Trade Center. And that evidence includes the evidence for molten metal, of which there's an enormous amount of testimony, photographic evidence, and environmental evidence and so forth. And I presented that topic on molten metal for the most part on the third day of the hearings.
Tell us about the reception of the Toronto hearings so far and what kind of comments they've generated.
Well, we've gotten a lot of support on the website and through email. And I believe you mentioned that the DVD is now going into production. It's being produced by a film company called Press for Truth in Canada. They had previously made films on globalization. They're kind of just a really strong independent media company. And they produced this DVD a little over 5 hours, boiled down from 20 plus hours. And the first print is, I guess if you call it that, the first round of DVDs is being produced this week. In addition to that, there was an agreement between the Toronto hearings and the Remember Building 7 campaign. You may know it used to be called Building What, and then it evolved into Remember Building 7. It's a very good initiative. They had a 10th anniversary campaign, and we agreed with them that whoever would donate $50 to the Remember Building 7 10th anniversary campaign would get a DVD. So we're going to produce all those DVDs as well, send them to Remember Building 7, and they'll get mailed out. And in addition to that, the report is ongoing in production. And I don't have a very recent update from Attorney Gurley, but I understand that it's coming along well.
Well, and for people who are more interested in information about the hearings and potentially to order a DVD, what websites can they visit?
The DVD can be ordered at pressfortruth.ca. So it's Canadian company, pressfortruth.ca. And if you go there, there'll be a link, I believe the first thing you'll see is a little blurb about the Toronto hearings DVD. Just click on that; it should pull up an option for you to purchase the DVD. The report is yet to come, and when that's available, we will probably have that for purchase at the International Center for 9/11 studies. I can't say for sure, but that would be my guess.
All right. Well, then finally, Kevin, let's talk about what you're working on next and what we might expect in the future from Kevin Ryan.
Well, I'm working on an awful lot of different things. I continue to have a little bit of work progress done on my scientific work related to the World Trade Center dust. I'm also very much interested in learning more about who might have been involved in the crimes of 9/11. That's a little tricky. I don't want to be seen as a conspiracy theorist, but I am at risk of becoming a conspiracy theorist with that sort of approach. What I'd like to do, though, is highlight those people that I believe need more investigation. For example, I think that it's reasonable to say, for most people who've looked into 9/11, that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld should be investigated relative to the possibility that they were involved or aware of the 9/11 crimes. From there, we can go to other people who are close associates with them. And I'm very interested in learning more about the history of deep state events, because I believe 9/11 was what Peter Dale Scott calls a deep state event. That is, it's an event that was coordinated in some way by some sort of a secret intelligence network or secret financial network that works not necessarily for democratic nations, but for a different interest group. He uses the term overworld. Just these terms are useful in that there's just, to date, there hasn't been a lot of good ways to describe this sort of thing. Conspiracy theories, for example, is a term used widely to criticize people who question the government's conspiracy theory. So it becomes difficult to even discuss the issues when we don't have good terms. Deep state events, overworld, those are good terms that Peter Dale Scott has come up with that I'm learning to use in a useful way to try to describe the the need to investigate people other than just the 19 alleged hijackers and Osama bin Laden, who was apparently killed and buried at sea, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times. We need to get information. We need the transparency from the primary documentation, as we discussed. We also need to be creative enough and detailed enough in our investigations to suggest what more could be investigated, including people and organizations.
Well, extremely important research, so I certainly wish you the best in all of that research. Kevin Ryan, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Just finally, could you throw out your own website for the Bloomington 9/11 Working Group?
Yeah, 911workinggroup.org, 911workinggroup.org is the local group. I have a blog at digwithin.net, and I'm the co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. That's journalof911studies.com.
Kevin Ryan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, James.